MacCast, Sunday, October 11th, 2015. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Another beautiful day here in Southern California, in San Diego. Actually, it's been getting a bit warm again, but always nice to have good weather and get to hang out. I hope you're having a great weekend, or if you're listening to this later, I guess it may be past your weekend already. I always got to remember about the time shifting in podcast. I never know when you're actually listening to the show. But regardless, we have a ton of great stuff to talk about in this episode. Specifically, we're going to talk a little bit about the Steve Jobs film. It opened in select cities, and yours truly actually got a chance to go see it. So we're going to avoid spoilers, I hope, and talk a little bit about the conflict that's arisen against different parties involved or not involved in the movie, or actually just folks who've known Steve Jobs. There's kind of divided camps. Some people are loving the movie, some refuse to see it and are judging it anyway, and I'm going to share my opinions after having seen it. So I think that's going to be a lot of fun. Elon Musk has claimed that Apple is staffing their car project with zombies. We're going to talk a little bit about that, an interesting story that cropped up this week. Also, Apple started shipping watch lugs for third-party bands, something that I'm excited about, and there may be some new iMacs on the way. And then, of course, we can't escape a new product launch without a gate. So there's a new gate surrounding the iPhone, and I'm talking about things like, antenna gate, and we had, you know, other kinds of gates. Of course, we've got to do that. So we're going to talk about that a little bit and then get to some of your feedback. Going to have possible reasons why you may not want to upgrade to El Capitan if you haven't done that yet. Also, some people concerned about the loss of secure empty trash in the new operating system. Going to talk a little bit about iCloud backups, and I have a great thing of the moment for you in this episode. So stay tuned for all of that. But before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Squarespace. You know, almost anything you do now or want to do, whether you're starting a service, starting a business, working with a club or an organization, you probably need to build a website. And you may or may not be a programmer. And if you're not, really, what are you going to do? You could teach yourself some code and learn how to create a website, but that takes time. You might hire somebody, but that can end up costing a lot of money, and you may not exactly get the site you want. And that is where Squarespace comes in. You know, I'm a web developer, and I've used Squarespace myself on several projects because sometimes you really just don't have the time, you don't have the budget, and Squarespace makes it easy to get a professionally designed site regardless of your skill level, no coding required. Very affordable. Everything's included. It is great. And you can go as simple or as complex as you need. You know, oftentimes you just need a single page, simple site. They have this thing called cover pages for that. You need to go more advanced. They have all kinds of things that you can add in. E-commerce, photo galleries. If you're doing a portfolio, there's great designs and templates for that. You want to do a blog, you need maps and directions, that's built in. You want to add in social media support, it is all in there. And their user interface makes it really easy to get going. And what I really appreciate is that once you've got the basics outlined, if you want to dig in deeper, if you want to get into code, if you want to really massage things, they have the ability to do that as well. And their plans start at just $8 a month. And you can get a free domain if you sign up for a year. And you can start a free trial site just to check it out without any credit card required. All you have to do is go to squarespace.com/MacCast. And when you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code MacCast, and you're going to get 10% off your first purchase. So you can save even more money building a great website with Squarespace. Squarespace, build it beautiful, and a big thank you to Squarespace for their support of the MacCast. going to kick off today talking a little bit about Apple Pay. You know, if you listen to the show, I love Apple Pay, but one of my big frustrations is that retailers seem to be very slow at adopting Apple Pay. It's been a sort of complaint of a lot of people. Now, Apple is claiming that they're continuing to see double-digit monthly growth of Apple Pay transactions since they launched the service. This was given in a statement to Bloomberg, but that actually contradicts what some Apple Pay retailers are saying. Panera Bread and Firehouse told the publication that they're seeing Apple Pay transactions make up the low single-digit percentages of the overall purchases that they're taking at their locations. Firehouse commented further on the frustration of Apple not making marketing on Apple Pay enough of a priority. And I would argue that it seems to me the retailers are also doing very little to promote the technology. Most of the retailers I go into, I think Panera Bread is one of those exceptions, but a lot of the retailers that I go into that accept Apple Pay don't have any kind of branding or marketing. You don't see signs on the doors, you don't see signs around the registers. There's very little information on the payment terminals. I think a lot of people don't realize they can actually use Apple Pay at some of these locations. And I don't know if the blame falls on Apple or the retailers. I have a feeling it goes a little bit both ways. I think there's employee education that needs to happen. That's been another frustration of mine. You'll go in and you'll ask if they support Apple Pay and they won't even know. And then you can try it and sure enough, it works. And even the employees sometimes act surprised when I use Apple Pay at their location. They say, "Oh, wow, that was really cool. That was really awesome. I wish more people would use that." But again, I think there is an awareness factor that's happening here, and I really do think Apple needs to step it up and work with their partner retailers to kind of get the message out, get people knowing that, hey, Apple Pay is a thing, outside of tech circles, and people with new phones need to know that they have the ability to use it. There was also a survey that was conducted that claims a lot of users will actually set up the feature and then only use it one time, and users also didn't seem to understand the benefits enough to continue to use Apple Pay. So again, that kind of falls back on Apple on doing a little bit better education of iPhone owners of how Apple Pay works. And I don't know if that means, sending out an email. It probably means doing a little more marketing and advertising, especially on television. I haven't seen too many TV commercials that are solely focused on Apple Pay that really explain, the benefits and what Apple Pay does for you. So, again, I think we're at this place where Apple Pay has been doing great and been making a lot of great progress at the banks and with the credit card companies, but really it's at retail locations accepting Apple Pay where Apple needs to put a lot of their effort. They also need to put more effort into rolling out internationally. I know we've got the UK and there's been word that Apple Pay is being enabled in China, I believe. But Apple needs to really get on the expansion and make this thing much more ubiquitous and easier for consumers to use. And then I think those numbers will continue to go up. But a little bit of discrepancy this week between, sort of what Apple is thinking the growth of Apple Pay is and what maybe some of their partner retailers are saying. So I mentioned that the Steve Jobs film opened in limited release this weekend, actually on Friday. It opened in New York and in Los Angeles. As near as I can tell, there was just three locations. I saw two in New York and one in LA, although one report I read said there were four theaters currently showing the movie. I think it's also going to be rolling out next week to a few more cities and locations, including Boston. And I think possibly Toronto. I'm not really sure. You're gonna have to check your local, listings or your local theaters to see when it's coming to your area. The wide release is supposed to happen on October 23rd. Now, I am gonna be talking about the film a little bit, mostly about just the structure and the people involved with it and what some people are saying about the film. I am not going to be giving really any spoilers in here. I don't think I am, but I just want to start off with a little bit of warning that we are gonna be talking about the film in sort of a roundabout way. So if you really don't want to know anything about it before you see it, you may want to skip this section. And, you know, a lot of the things covered are the things that were covered in a lot of the biographies. So if you've read the Steve Jobs book, you know the details, but I'm not even going to be going into any of those details. But for those of you who might be sensitive about this, just know we're going to be talking about it, and you may want to skip it if you want to know nothing about the film. So you've been warned, and here we go. The movie's written by Aaron Sorkin and directed by Danny Boyle, and loosely based on the Walter Isaacson biography, although both the writer and the director have commented saying that, you know, it really was meant to be, I think Aaron Sorkin's saying more of an impressionistic painting than a biopic. They very much stress that it's not a biopic, but the film seems to be polarizing a lot of the top name people who knew Jobs. And what I found interesting is that those who knew him in the early days of his career seem to be really liking the film and saying good things about it. A lot of these people are also people who were involved with the project. They either consulted on the film or met with the directors. So this is Woz has said great things about it, and we do know that he consulted on the film and was reportedly paid about $200,000 for that consultation. You also have John Scully, who's featured in the film and said he really liked it. Andy Hertzfeld, who also is featured in the film, and also Andrea or Andy Cunningham. All of them have said good, positive things about the film. They essentially all agree that the events and the exact way that things happened in the film are not accurate at all. There's a lot of creative license that went on there. I think Andy Hertzfeld's direct quote was that it deviates from reality everywhere. So they, you know, you're not really going to see exact events as they happened historically, but they all also seem to agree that really what's going on here is the director seems to be trying to show the emotions of these people, specifically Jobs and the people around him, also the why he does the things he does or acts and behaves the way that he does. And they all seem to feel that that why was sort of very accurate. You know, what were the motivations behind these people for doing the things that they did and reacting and acting the way that they did? And I think Woz said, you know, he really saw Steve Jobs in the portrayal of Michael Fassbender, and I'm probably mutilating his name, but he's the main character. And, you know, Seth Rogen, he even commented, Seth Rogen, who plays Jobs, he really felt did a great job. And apparently Rogen and Woz hung out, and so they kind of got to know each other. So they did kind of dig into these characters and try and get the personalities and the feelings and those things portrayed accurately. Even if the specific things that Sorkin wrote didn't exactly happen the way they did in the film, or some were even completely made up for the film. And the goal really seems to have been reaching this understanding of why was Steve Jobs the way he was? What were the things that motivated him to behave in the way that he was, that give us these actual stories that we've heard, you know, sort of the mythology and the lore that we've heard around Steve Jobs. And I think it's a good reminder to, you know, remind everybody, everybody has different perspectives about people and their interactions with people. And, you know, a lot of the specifics, I think, get lost in time. You just have the interpretation of people and sort of the remembrance and the feelings, right? If you ask anybody to talk about stuff that happened 20, 30, 40 years ago, I think you're going to get a colored perspective anyway. So really, how accurate can you be? You have, you know, different accounts, I guess you could kind of pull together, but you're never going to get 100% historical accuracy. Another thing that happens in filmmaking is there's a lot of condensing that needs to happen. And this happens a lot in all kinds of films. You've got to put things together. So I've heard some reports and things where it says, well, you know, Sorkin kind of took two or three events and compressed them into one, or added in events that happened at different times, but, you know, so that it can fit in the flow of the film. But again, he was going after the actual intent. And again, I guess this may be a little bit of a spoiler, so you might want to avoid this. But this has been discussed. If you've read anything about the film, you probably know this, and that is how the structure of it goes. It's based around the product launches for three major products, Apple products, the original Macintosh, and then the, I guess they're not all Apple products. It was the next computer, three major Steve Jobs products. So the original Macintosh, the next, and then the iMac. So, you know, the idea is you have the rise of Steve, kind of the fall of Steve, the low point, and then the redemption of Steve, I guess, with coming back to Apple in the iMac. And that's all compressed into this 2 hour, I think it's 2 hour and 2 minute film. And so you have that, and you have these people who knew him in the older days and who were working on the film sort of, you know, singing the praises of the film. And then you have the people who are being most critical of the film being the folks who, in general, knew Steve later in his life. So Tim Cook has come out very publicly and said that he considers these films to be opportunistic. Ive has been critical of the film. We've heard reports that Steve's widow, Lorraine Powell, tried to block the film both when it was at Sony and Universal, basically stop it from being produced. She was saying she felt that the script really played down his accomplishments and portrayed Jobs as cruel and inhumane. Now, again, remember, she has not seen the film. The studio invited her to see it, to be involved in the project, to read the screenplay, but she declined. And I can totally understand the aversions of the people who were closest to Steve, especially the ones, I think, who were closest to him at the end of his life. Because it really hasn't been that many years. We just passed the four-year mark of Steve Jobs' passing. And I think anybody can sympathize that we want to remember our family members and friends who have passed by sort of the great achievements and accomplishments of their lives. The highlights, right? But that isn't everything about a person. That's not the whole story. And so when you're talking about a movie or a biography or something like that, you want to know all the parts of that human being. And Steve had many great parts, big, huge achievements. He had a loving family. He was loving and caring to the people around him. He had great friends. But he also had a darker side to him that was part of who he was as well. And all these things sort of go to make up this icon. You know, he's an icon for many people. So outside that circle, there's a lot of us who didn't know him directly. And we look up to him. We appreciate his achievements. We also want to strive to understand all the parts of him, all his nuances. At least that's the way it is for me. And we know from these stories of other people who are close to him that he could sometimes be unrelenting and cruel and tyrannical. And these were parts of his personality as well. And the film is kind of trying to figure out, you know, how do you reconcile someone who has all of these traits, the good and the bad? How does he make the decisions that he makes? How does he come to do that? And you're never really going to know without being able to sort of ask the man directly. And even when you ask the person directly, you know, they're going to have their own take and perspective. So I think at least the films and the books and things like that are trying to explore this from a bunch of different angles. And that's really what I've tried to do leading up to this. You know, I try to consume everything. I've read most of the Steve Jobs books. I've seen most of the films, you know, Pirates of the Silicon Valley, the Lost Steve Jobs tapes, all in trying to figure out this understanding of who was this guy that made these products that I have a physical connection to, you know, an emotional connection to. I do a podcast about this stuff. I mean, why would I do this if I wasn't really interested in and want to understand sort of who this person is? So, you know, the good news is I live not far from Los Angeles. I'm in San Diego. It's about a 2 hour drive. So I actually got to see the film. I drove to the theater where it was playing in LA. The Landmark on Pico Boulevard, in case you're wondering and maybe want to go see it for yourself. Again, I'm going to try really hard to avoid spoilers here, but I kind of want to discuss elements of the film because my sort of two-word review of this film is insanely great. It is awesome. I absolutely loved it. I think far and away, it is the best film about Steve Jobs that I've seen. Prior to this, I would probably have told you that Pirates of the Silicon Valley was my favorite film, and that's still a great film. I think it's well worth seeing if you haven't seen it. But in that film, it was very much a chronological sequence of events. I think it also had a little bit of humor and things like that in it. And it was a little bit of a lighter film. I mean, there were some dark and serious moments, but in general, I view that as a little, lighter take on Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and sort of the rise of the Macintosh and things like that. But this film really, I think, tried to delve into figuring out who Steve Jobs was and why he did the things that he did. And it does it in a really amazing way. And it's very dramatic, of course, being a Sorkin, written thing. And the dialogue is amazing. But beyond just the dialogue and the acting is incredible too. You've got incredible actors in there. You've got, Scarlett Johansson, and you've got Seth Rogen, who does a really great job. You think of him more as a comedian, but, very serious role in this film. Blanking on the guy who played Andy Hertzfeld and, the woman who played Andy Cunningham. But it's just the performances are great and it's shot beautifully. They also did this great thing mechanically where they shot each segment in the film technology that was available at the time. So I think you start out with I think it's 16 millimeter or 35 millimeter in film in the Mac segment, original Macintosh segments. And then in the next segments, I think you go to 70 millimeter film and then finishing up with the iMac with digital technology. And you don't really, I didn't really notice the differences, but it's subtle and they do great job with the music. And, the whole thing is really, really well put together. And I don't think that's really all that surprising. But what was amazing to me is sort of the nuances. And I think it's going to take several viewings of this film to sort of get it. But they did a great job of balancing, putting together a great story. And again, I'm not going to give you any spoilers on the story stuff, but just know that they used a mechanism throughout the film to really drive the story of Steve and his relationships with the people around him. But then beyond that, to sort of satisfy, I think, what I would call the biopic elements of it, is they did a great job of getting in the facts, and they used some great mechanisms to get the facts and the details in without having to detract from the overarching storyline that they were trying to tell. And they did a great job of putting in all the little bits and pieces that nerds like us will glob onto in terms of the different technologies that were developed and the different sort of elements, that we have come to know about the story about Steve Jobs. The bio, the factual stuff is all in there too, but it's in there in a very sort of subtle way, just running through the background of various scenes and not detracting from the overall drama of the main story. And then even beyond that, there is some very interesting subtext elements that happen throughout the film. And you're going to notice some things. I read an article about this, so I was specifically looking for some things. And if you look very, very closely, you're going to notice some very poignant things that happen, interactions that the characters do that are very subtle, that have to do with how the sets are arranged, with have to do with how the characters interact with props and objects throughout the film, that if you're looking for them, sort of play into the feelings and the emotions and the things that are happening at the time. I'm being, extremely vague about this. If you want to know more specifics about the details, you're welcome to email me, and I'll maybe email them back to you. But I don't want to give away too much of the film. But bottom line is you are going to want to see this film. If you're at all an Apple fan, if you're at all interested in Steve Jobs, you are really going to want to see this film because I think it's one of the best ones and I can't wait to go see it again. I don't think I'm going to drive 2 hours to LA to see it, but in a couple of weeks, I'm sure I'm going to be hitting the theaters again to give this another viewing. And I'm going to want to view it a few more times to sort of get all of the nuances of it. But I know, I think it's not surprising that a film done by Sorkin and Danny Boyle is, incredibly great. And I now am asking myself, would Cook and Ive and Lorraine feel different about this film if they saw it? And I know that Sorkin seems to think that they would. I think it's not, it's definitely not a wholly negative portrayal of Steve Jobs. I think you get the humanity of him, you get the emotion of him by the end of the, you know, by the end of the film, and they really do show how he changed. The other thing about sort of the portrayal is you have to remember this ends in, I think, 1997, if I'm not mistaken, 97, 98, somewhere in that range. I think Steve came back in 97. And then the original iMac was launched in 98. So it's right around that time frame. And again, the early days, Steve Jobs, I think, was just like we all are when we're younger, you know, much more passionate, much more, I don't even want to say naive, but kind of arrogant, right? When we're younger, we think we can do everything. And then as you get older, you change, you soften a little bit. And I think Steve did that throughout his life. But even still, by the time this film ends, we don't have the Steve that I think Tim Cook and Jony Ive really knew, the guy that they worked with, who was much older, much wiser, I think a lot more introspective. He still had the rough edges, but I think he was very different. And I think part of the reaction to the, you know, this film might be that this isn't the Steve that I know. And this is what they keep saying over and over again. And it isn't the Steve that they knew, but it is still a Steve Jobs, a version of Steve Jobs that, you know, I want to understand and get to know. And I think this film did a really great job of doing that. So that's my thoughts on the film. I am, you know, hoping that you're going to get to see it relatively soon. I know it's coming to some additional theaters between now and the 23rd, but by the 23rd, maybe in a couple of weeks, we can all sit down and have a little bit of back and forth about this. Well, if you do get an opportunity to see this film, if you're in New York or the LA area or happen to travel there, send us your thoughts and comments because I'm really curious to see if you like it as much as I do. I think there's going to be a lot of people that don't, but I think, you know, I think they did a really great job and it's a great film. Last time we talked a little bit about some of Apple's recent acquisitions, I told you that Apple had acquired a company called Vocal IQ. They're a UK startup with a natural language API that incorporates machine learning. Well, it looks like Apple is continuing to expand that part of their portfolio. This week, we've been hearing reports that Apple has purchased a company called Perceptio, which is a small startup focused on artificial intelligence. Apparently, the company was founded by a couple of artificial intelligence researchers who specialize in creating image recognition systems using deep learning. Perceptio is specifically focused on how to run complex neural network algorithms on smartphones using pattern-based processing. I have no idea what any of that means, but basically, my understanding of it is that they want to enable smartphones to be able to run in advanced artificial intelligence systems that will allow the phone to process and react to user data that is stored locally on the device without actually having to go out to large external data repositories or, you know, collect a lot of data beyond just the device itself. And if you know anything about what Apple's been trying to do with Siri and specifically with protecting users' privacy, this seems like a really good fit for Apple because one of the limitations that Siri has had when trying to do sort of predictive analysis of data and kind of anticipate the things that we're going to want is that Apple can't do like Google and Amazon are doing, which is collect a bunch of data, store it on their servers, and then process it. If you've ever, you know, had your email in Gmail, for example, and you know that you have a flight receipt, a receipt for a flight or something like that. If you go to Google on the day that you have your flight, it will pull up your flight information automatically for you. I've had this happen to me because I used my Google login with TripIt, and TripIt is sort of attached into my Google data, And so it knows about my flights and things like that. And that can end up being a little bit creepy, right? I didn't specifically ask for that information, but Google search engine knows I might be looking for that because they've analyzed data that's in another part of a system from another company that's not even directly associated with Google. That's the kind of thing that Apple wants to avoid. So they'd love Siri to know that on the morning, you know, you have a flight, you're going to wake up and probably ask about your flight, but it's not going to use external data to do that. And so they need a system that can bring AI directly onto the phone. And it sounds like this Perceptio technology might actually enable that to happen. So they can do that without actually having to compromise your privacy. It can go through and analyze different parts of your phone. So what's in your contacts database? What's in your email? What's in other applications? Maybe something like my TripIt app, but it doesn't have to go out to the TripIt database. TripIt doesn't have to know it's looking up that information, that sort of thing. It can stay all on the device, protecting the user privacy. So it's interesting to see Apple acquiring these AI companies. And, you know, that's just one aspect where they could use this kind of technology. They also have the car project and interactive, you know, machine learning could come into play there as well. So Apple continuing to expand its portfolio. Of course, when asked about it, they just gave their patent answer that Apple acquires smaller companies all of the time, and it's just something that normally happens. So we don't know exactly what's going to go on. But I mean, if you look at the kinds of technologies they're pulling together here, I think it's a pretty safe bet to assume that this is going to get rolled into parts of Siri, and we're going to get a much more intelligent, proactive, predictive Siri. And I think that's going to be awesome. I told you at the top of the show, Apple has started shipping the watch lugs. This is a story that I'm actually really excited about. If you don't know what a lug is on the Apple Watch, the little part that slides into the watch body itself to attach the strap, that's what I'm talking about. And to date, we have not had any third-party straps that are part of Apple's Made for Apple Watch program. They're not certified by Apple. So they've kind of reverse engineered the lug. These are the official lugs from Apple, from Apple's partner who's manufacturing them. Third-party developers can now order them. As a matter of fact, they even say on the lug themselves, it's etched with the term Made for Apple Watch. That's how you're going to know you have official ones. I guess that could be replicated and copied as well. So buyer beware. But you're going to want to look on the packaging. If it says Made for Apple Watch, that's part of Apple's Made for I program. And developers, people who want to make accessories have to be part of that program in order to use that logo. They can be ordered. The lugs themselves can be ordered in batches of sets of 25 or sets of 200. Pricing starts around $278.75 for 25 38 millimeter lugs. If you do the math on that, that's about $11 per set. So these things are not cheap. You also need to order, I guess, a special pentalobe screwdriver. Of course, it's Apple, right? So that you can actually attach your strap to the lug. And those are $13 US, $12.65. So I fully expect that those prices, the Made for I third-party bands, the sort of Apple-blessed and certified bands, are going to be still a bit on the pricier side compared to the non-Made for I models that are going to be on the market. Now, you might be asking yourself, what does it matter? You know, if someone's figured out how to make the little lug and they can make it for $2 versus $11 a set, isn't that better? Does it really matter? Well, the one thing is that these lugs are the only officially Apple-endorsed lugs. I don't know if that plays into any warranty issues. Like if you had one of these third-party ones and it got stuck or didn't function properly, you know, would Apple cover you under AppleCare? That's not really clear at this point. I think they probably would, but, you know, we're not talking about a majorly complex electronic component or something like that. But I've also heard, and this is not confirmed, and if you happen to know a little bit about the science behind this, the metallurgy, I've heard that some metals, when they come in contact with other different types of metals, can not enhance, but sort of accelerate or maybe even cause corrosion if they're not two compatible metals. I don't know if this is a reality or not. I know there's a whole, electrolysis thing in terms of plating and electroplating where this is true. But, you know, if you get a stainless steel lug and you kind of mix it with an aluminum material. And I think Apple's lugs, I want to say that they're stainless steel. And but my thing is Apple would have tested to make sure that there's no issues between, say, the 7000 series aluminum and stainless steel lugs that they might be selling for third-party bands. I don't know if that's going to be the case for these other ones that are, made by other vendors out of China. Do they have nickel material in them, and how does nickel react with 7000 series aluminum, or copper? Who knows what other kinds of metals may be used in making those lugs. Is that an issue or not? I really don't know, but I'd like to know. So if you happen to know, let me know, and we'll try to share that out on a future episode. But for now, I think if I'm looking for a watch band, I am going to be looking for the made for Apple Watch official certified ones. And hopefully we'll see some of those bands soon. It's been a while. I've been waiting on them. It'll be interesting to see how pricing shakes out. It's sounding like, or looking like, we may actually finally see the rumored 4K 21.5-inch Retina iMac. 9to5 Mac is saying that several of their reliable sources believe that it will be released next week. They claim the new model could begin showing up in Apple retail stores as soon as Tuesday, October 13th. On the exterior, the machines are said to look exactly identical to the current 21-inch models, so no real design changes. This is mostly a screen and internal change. I don't know if they're getting new processors, but they are saying that it'll have the 4K display running at a resolution of 4096 by 2304. Also, have a better GPU to drive that 4K display. The resolution apparently will give it a pixel density of about 218 pixels per inch, which I guess is in line with the current 27-inch 5K iMac. We've also been hearing rumors that Apple has some new accessories in development: a new Magic Mouse, new Magic trackpads, and also a wireless keyboard. One of the things we're hearing is that the Magic Mouse and Magic trackpad may have some of the Force Touch technology built into them. The keyboard is expected to have the same kind of butterfly keys that are found in the new MacBook. And all three devices reportedly have built-in batteries that are rechargeable. It's not really clear how you would recharge them, but it would be great if it was some sort of induction charging mechanism, kind of like the Apple Watch. I have not heard that, but that would be a great way to go. And the other thing on the accessories that is doubtful, but some people have hinted at, is that they may have Touch ID technology. That is something I don't think is going to happen. But if they did, I've often thought that a great way to implement that, specifically on the keyboard and the trackpad, would be to simply build the Touch ID sensor around where the battery drawer currently is. The little circle that looks, battery drawer and I guess the power button, right? That would be the perfect location, and you could just kind of rest your finger along the side of the device to use the Touch ID. I guess it could also be somewhere built into the top of the keyboard. I don't know how you'd integrate it with a Magic Mouse, but again, I don't think that's going to happen, but Apple certainly could do it, I think, if they wanted to. Now, it's not clear whether or not the accessories would launch alongside a revved iMac, but there were some code hints that also showed up in the recent beta builds of OS X El Capitan that did indicate, again, these new devices: the new Magic Mouse, Magic Trackpad, and Keyboard, version 2 of all of those products. So it could happen next week. The accessories could come out later, but it does sound like we will get a new iMac relatively soon. So if you've been in the market for it, you may want to hold off a week or so to see what happens. And then 9to5 Mac is also saying that, according to their reliable sources, the Apple TV and the iPad Pro are going to go on pre-order at the end of October and start shipping and be available in stores the first week of November. And that's a little bit interesting because while Apple did say the Apple TV would arrive in October, they said the iPad Pro would be in November, and it's sounding like that's getting fudged a little bit, with both being available for pre-order in October and then both shipping in November. I'm not super happy about that personally because I was hoping they'd be spread out a little bit to ease up on my bank account, that I'd be able to buy the Apple TV and then maybe have a couple weeks to build up some more revenue so that I can buy that iPad Pro, because I'm definitely buying an iPad Pro with all of the accessories, and I'm really looking forward to testing that out. And of course, we'll be talking about that when I get it on future episodes of the MacCast. Are you ready for Chipgate? Yes, we have a new gate. Yay! Apple is doomed. Ah, no. You know, here we are. As we discussed last week, Apple has two sources for their A9 chip, and those chips are using different manufacturing processes. 14 nanometer for Samsung and 16 nanometer for the TSMC chips. And, you know, looking at the exterior of the phone, you're not going to know which chip you have. If you were able to have X-ray vision like Superman and look inside, you would notice that the TSMC chip is slightly larger, you know, by a few millimeters than the Samsung chip. And now you can actually use some tools like iMazing to go in and figure out which chip you have based on the chip model number. So you can kind of figure it out, and people started to discover this. And this week, it started to raise questions of, is it going to make a difference which chip you have, if you have the Samsung one or if you have the TSMC one? And so the internet does what it always does and started trolling to figure out a way to make one look better than the other. And a few places started to run benchmark battery tests on the various chips, and then started claiming that the TSMC chips were outperforming the Samsung chips, in some cases, by a very large factor. As a matter of fact, they claimed in heavy use that the TSMC chip was performing 1.5 times better, or up to 1.5 times better than the Samsung chip. But here's the thing. Before you get all worried and start investigating your chip and decide, oh, I've got the Samsung one, I'm taking it back to Apple and I hope to get the TSMC one. Because the other weird thing about even trying to do that is you're not going to know. Even if they swap out your phone, you're not going to know unless, again, you bring your X-ray vision into the Apple store. And as far as I know, again, Superman, only human on the planet that I know that would be able to do that. But here's the thing. They started doing real-world tests on the same chips, doing something like, for example, playing an hour-long YouTube video on the devices, and when they did that, it only showed about a 1% difference in battery life. So the differences were being shown when you basically put it on a benchmark test and maxed out everything, the CPU and the display and everything, for, you know, a long, long period of time. And another thing that they discovered when running those tests, just as a side note, was that the Samsung chip seemed to run about 3 degrees Celsius hotter and was a little bit faster. So you got a little bit more performance out of the Samsung chip. And of course, the press immediately turned around and started reporting on this and dubbed it Chipgate, because every new Apple device that comes out now, we have to have some sort of gate associated with, right? It's crazy. But Apple did officially respond to the claims. They spoke to iMore and basically confirmed the real world versus lab tests. But they said certain manufactured lab tests, which run the processors with a continuous heavy workload until the battery depletes, are not representative of real world usage. They claim it's a misleading way to measure real world battery life. And let's face it, real world battery life is what we care about. How many of us are going to be benchmarking our phones? You can't use your phone while you're benchmarking it, so you can throw it on there and max it out and wait until the battery depletes and, you know, see how much the difference in battery life is. But that's not how you're going to use your phone. You're going to take your phone off the charger, you're going to use it the way you use it throughout the day, and you're going to see how much battery you have left. And if you use it that way, according to Apple's tests, they say the difference in battery life varies between 2 to 3%. And even the tests that were happening on the internet showed a similar result in real-world usage. So again, here we have a gate. And again, it's a totally non-issue for those of us who use our devices as intended. So you do not need to worry about this. And let's move on. And with that, actually, let's move on in the show because that is all of the news that I have for you this week. Before we do move on, though, I do want to take a moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is Gazelle. Hey, do you want to get cash for some of your old devices? Gazelle makes it super easy. And as we just talked about, new iPad Pros, new Apple TVs are right around the corner. You might be wanting to spend some money on some new Apple gear. Now is the perfect time to lock in pricing and get a great deal on your old devices with Gazelle. Just head to gazelle.com, and what you're going to find out is they make it totally free and easy to get an offer in just minutes. All you have to do is answer a few easy questions about the condition, about the accessories you have, and right there you're going to get an instant price quote from Gazelle. And you don't even need to worry if your device is broken because Gazelle will buy back those devices as well. So go there, plug in your info, see what your offer is, and once you accept it, you have 30 days to send in your device, and Gazelle is going to honor it. And in many cases, they will send you a box to ship it back in. The shipping is always free, so they take care of that. And any personal information, all that stuff is removed from your devices once they receive it. And once they do receive it, you're going to get paid fast, and you can get paid by check in the mail. You can opt to get an Amazon gift card, which you're going to get 5% more on your offer, or you can do direct deposit into your PayPal account. So you can get paid quickly and easily. And Gazelle has helped over 1 million customers sell their devices, and they've paid out over $200 million to those customers over the years. So you can get cash for your old device, lock in your price today. You have 30 days to send it in. That's going to give you plenty of time, and you just need to go to gazelle.com to get your offer today. And a big thank you to Gazelle for their continued support of the MacCast. So many people are upgrading to OS X El Capitan. It's going really great for most people. I've heard generally very positive results with very few exceptions. Every once in a while, there's a little fluke and something happens. I have heard some instances of some people having the install hang up midway and having to reboot and sort of go back to recovery disks and stuff like that. That's why we always tell you do your backups because it can happen, but it seems to be very rare. Almost, 90% of the people that I've talked to about their El Capitan upgrades, they said, yep, I just ran it. It works great. It's actually even performing better than OS X Yosemite. I am loving it. But still, there may be some reasons why you might want to hold off and not upgrade to El Capitan yet. For me personally, I haven't done it yet because it's a bigger project for me. I have a lot going on my system, and I want to do a clean install. So I just haven't had the time. I need to set aside the time to do that. And that's a valid reason maybe not to upgrade yet. But there's been some other issues that I wanted to make sure that you were aware of. We've had some reports of issues with Microsoft Office applications, both Office 2011 and 2016. Specifically, it looks like the main app that's having trouble is Outlook, but apparently, if you start to have Outlook issues, it can kind of spill over and have some issues with some of the other applications, specifically apps not starting or crashing on wake from sleep. And Microsoft has confirmed that there is a problem and has come out and said that they are working on it. But if you rely on those applications day to day and they're very critical applications for you, you may want to hold off a little bit and make sure that Microsoft has had that sorted out before you jump into El Capitan. Another thing that I've heard some issues with are audio interfaces. Apple has made some big changes to core audio. So if you work a lot with audio gear, we've seen some reports of some people, depending upon their hardware and the drivers and things like that, having sporadic issues. If you do work with that kind of technology, you're going to at least want to check with the manufacturer of your gear to make sure that it's compatible with OS X El Capitan. And always double check the compatibility of your audio software as well. I had one listener report to me that he was having issues with sending system audio to multiple AirPlay devices because Apple's audio MIDI setup isn't working in the same way as it was in El Capitan. He had a specific application that he was using for playing higher quality audio files. So he didn't play his music through iTunes. He used another application that relied on Apple's audio MIDI setup to send the audio to AirPlay. And so if you're in that scenario, you may want to check that that out as well and make sure that you're covered there. If you're a gamer and you use Game Center a lot, apparently the game invite functionality appears to be broken in El Capitan. That's the thing where you can, you know, challenge someone to a game through Game Center. Apparently you can still accept invites, you just can't send them. So if that's a big feature for you, you may want to hold off. Although I have been hearing that El Capitan does have improved OpenGL and Metal performance. So a lot of the games that use those technologies actually perform a lot better in the new operating system. So you're going to have to weigh, you know, Game Center functionality versus actually better performance on your games. And I think a lot of people, if you're, especially if you're a gamer, you're going to opt for the better performance. Just have your friends invite you and then you'll be okay. And then the last area, and this is really the area that has caused me to hold off a little bit. If you use Unix, if you use, you know, the BSD, if you're in the terminal a lot and rely on that, you may want to check and make sure, because Apple's System Integrity Protection, or SIP, which is a big new feature, security feature in OS X El Capitan, that locks down some key areas under the hood and some key directories that are under the hood in OS X. And I've heard reports you can actually disable SIP. Don't do that. This is a big critical security feature in El Capitan, and you want to leave it in place. So that's not the way to handle this. You need to figure other workarounds if you're impacted by it. But basically, not even root users can access certain directories like the user bin folders or the sbin folders or even the system folder. Those are totally locked down, and there are some low-level applications that, you know, in the past have relied on those folders. So you're going to need to check on those applications and figure out how you work around the SIP protection. So just do a little bit of your homework and research. And that's the kind of stuff that I'm doing, because I do rely on some applications that I install, say, through things like Homebrew and that sort of stuff that I need. Oh, and I guess there is one more. Apparently, AutoCAD 2013, 2014, or 2015 are not stable in El Capitan. So if you use those applications, they are either not launching or crashing frequently. So you're going to want to check with AutoCAD and see when they have an update for those applications. But beyond that, like I said, I think a lot of people are having pretty good success with El Capitan. If you have upgraded and want to share your story, good or bad, please send those along, especially audio comments. I'm curious to hear more from people who have upgraded and to hear how things are going. But like I said, generally, it sounds like things are good. Now, if you have upgraded, one area that is causing some concern for a few people, and as a matter of fact, many of you have contacted me with shock and frustration that a feature that has been available in prior versions is suddenly gone in OS X El Capitan, and that is the secure empty trash feature. This is a feature that when you would put something in the trash and then empty it, you could choose secure, and it would not only remove the file and, you know, sort of get rid of the location of it, but it would immediately overwrite that part of your disk with data, ensuring that the file could not be recovered by file recovery tools. That is gone now in El Capitan, and a lot of people are worried about security, because, you know, say you have some tax documents or something you want to make sure are expunged from your disk, you're not going to have that secure empty trash option. Now, some of the reports that I've been reading are pointing to a feature that is available in El Capitan called Delete Immediately. And you get at this, I guess, by holding down the Option key when you're going to empty the trash. And turns out that's not exactly the same thing. That's basically just a one-step process so that you don't have to, you know, empty the trash. So when you're throwing something away, you can have it immediately just deleted and not hanging out in the trash folder. Another good security feature, but not exactly the same as doing a secure empty trash. And there actually is a good reason why secure empty trash is no longer available. And it's actually pointed out in an Apple support page that explains an issue existed in guaranteeing secure deletion of trash files on some systems, such as those with flash storage. And as you know, more and more Macs have flash storage built into them now. The issue was addressed by removing the secure empty trash option. So They remove the feature, and again, this is a little bit vague, but they remove the feature because they couldn't always guarantee that the files were securely deleted. And you might be wondering why. I know I was wondering why. Well, Joe Kissel from Tidbits and Joe on Tech actually came to speak to my Mac user group and explained this. I guess what happened in a, is, a, and I missed the story a little while back, but some researchers here in San Diego were testing securely wiping SSD drives, and they found that in many cases, SSDs did not securely erase the data, even when specifically given a secure erase command. And this is my vague understanding because I'm not a hard drive expert, but apparently the problem lies in how the SSDs work. SSDs save data to physical pages, but they do not, but when you erase, they erase from something called logical block addresses, LBAs. And when deleting on an SSD, it basically just gets rid of the map to where the data is. It doesn't really delete the data. And once it's gotten rid of that map, it has no way to know where that data is. So if you're trying to point to it and overwrite it securely, it can't do that because there's no map. And so there ends up being these little bits of data sort of strewn all over the drive, and they end up being recoverable. And then another thing that you could do is sort of force what's called garbage collection to kind of go through and maybe expunge and wipe out some of that data. But you don't want to do that because doing that on an SSD actually causes additional wear and tear. SSDs only have so many read-write cycles that they can do. And if you're kind of forcing those read-write cycles, you're actually putting more wear and tear on the drive. So when the researchers looked at this, you know, not all SSDs exhibited the issues, but they tested 12 drives. And of the 12 that they tested, only four reliably actually erased their data. So Apple has sort of erred on the side of caution and took the feature out, because if they're saying, hey, we're securely erasing your data, and it turns out because of the technology in the underlying drive, it's not working, and the data is there, they could be potentially liable for, you know, data that you thought was securely erased not being gone. And if, you know, a bad guy gets a hold of your data, you're going to come back and blame Apple because you're going to say, hey, I securely deleted it and it didn't actually delete. So they've just completely removed the option. So what are you going to do if you have that kind of data and you're trying to remove it or you want to protect it? Well, one thing that you could do is simply just use whole disk encryption like FileVault 2 on your drive. So just go into the security settings, turn on FileVault 2, because at that point, the entire drive, all of the data on the drive is encrypted. So if someone got a hold of the drive or stole the drive, they're not going to be able to get into it at all. It doesn't matter if you've left little bits of data around the drive. It's all encrypted and you can't get at it. And while that's not perfect, it's much better than doing nothing, and you won't have to worry about the bits of data being left behind. But for now, that's how to handle it. I don't know if, you know, SSD manufacturers are going to do something to change this problem, but it's likely not going to happen soon. So Apple opted to remove the feature, and that's why it's gone. What would a Maccast be without some discussion or mention of backup? I'm not going to leave you hanging in this episode for sure. We talk about backup a lot, and one of the things that I often forget to talk about is checking and verifying your backups. We mention it from time to time, but it actually is a pretty important thing. And especially after doing an upgrade or moving to a new device, you can often forget, and I know I've forgotten to reset up backups. Well, I was reading a page, article rather, from Sebastian Page over at the iDownload blog, and he had a great piece about solving an issue with iCloud backups. And it really does serve as a good reminder to us that, hey, you know, we set up these automated backups and we kind of take a set it and forget it mentality, but every once in a while you might want to go in and just make sure things are happening the way that you think they are happening. So in the case of iCloud, you may want to go into settings, into iCloud, and into backup, and just check the status of your backups. See when the last backup ran. What happened to Sebastian is he noticed that after setting up his new device, it had not run at all. Basically, something happened and the backup was not running. And after I read this article, I went to check, and sure enough, I had forgotten completely to turn on iCloud backup. I hadn't even flipped the switch after upgrading to my new iPhone 6S. So you're going to want to double check that. Make sure that it's running. And if it's not, you can actually force a backup by tapping on the Backup Now option. And that's exactly what Sebastian did. But in his case, then what happened was he saw an error, and the error said that the last backup could not be completed. And he wanted to know, you know, how do you fix that? So if you do this and you run into that problem, or if you've just seen the issue, an alert pop up that says, hey, I tried to do the iCloud backup, it did not complete, and it's not working, there's a couple things that you can do to maybe get it running again. The first would be to make sure that you have enough available iCloud storage. And you can just go into the iCloud storage section and make sure that you haven't used up all of your storage. If you're okay there, then you might just simply want to try a reboot of your device. If you reboot it and the iCloud backup is still failing, at this point, you're probably going to want to pull a manual backup. So even if you're using iCloud backup, and I think a lot of people don't know this on your iOS devices, if you connect it to iTunes, you know, with the Lightning cable, and then go into iTunes, into the device, select it, and choose Backup Now, you can still click on Backup Now, and it will create a one-time local backup of your device. And so that's a great way, you know, before you upgrade or before you make any changes, to get a quick backup of your device. So give that a shot. And then if the reboot, again, did not work, you're probably going to have to go in and start resetting some things. And the simplest thing to start resetting would be your iCloud. So go into Settings, iCloud, sign out of iCloud at the bottom, and then sign back in. Now, just remember, when you do this, if you've set up Apple Pay, you're going to have to reset that up both on your phone and your watch. But try resetting iCloud, logging out, logging back in, and see if that doesn't unstick the backup. If that doesn't work, then it may be an issue with your network settings and just with the connectivity to iCloud. So you can go into Settings, General, Reset, and reset your network settings. Now, just note that this is going to get rid of all of your known Wi-Fi networks and settings. You're going to have to reconnect to your Wi-Fi networks. You're going to have to re-enter your passwords. So make sure that you have those handy before you do this. And if that doesn't work for you, you might want to check any backups that might already be in iCloud. And actually, this is the one that worked for Sebastian. What he discovered was that even though iCloud was reporting that it hadn't done a backup, there actually was a backup in his iCloud storage. And he ended up having to just delete that backup and then run the iCloud backup again, and then everything was fine. So if you want to check on that, what you can do is you can go into Settings on your device, go to iCloud, go to Storage, go to Manage Storage, and then you will see your iCloud backups for all your devices there. And if you see one sitting there that is for your current device, that could be actually blocking future backups. So you'll want to delete that and then immediately try to run a backup. And that first backup is going to take longer than it normally does, because it has to basically rebuild the whole thing. And remember, you already had the manual backup that you pulled into iTunes, right? So make sure you have that before you do this step, because once you delete the backup that's in iCloud, if you don't have that iTunes backup, then you really have no backup, and you don't want to be in that kind of scenario. So if you try all of these things and that still isn't working, you're probably down to having to do a restore of your device. And again, you're going to want to have that that local iTunes backup, because you're going to erase and restore your device from backup, and that could unstick things. So between one of these fixes, it's probably going to fix any errors that you're having with iCloud backups. So give all of those a try. The last thing that I want to mention on this is just generally checking your storage and making sure that you don't have any old backups for devices that you don't have anymore. One of the things as I was going through this that I noticed was when I went into Settings, iCloud Storage, Manage Storage, I actually had a backup for the iPhone 6 Plus that I sold. And so I really don't need that backup anymore. So I went into Manage Storage and I deleted that backup. And you can do that by simply tapping on the device and then, you know, picking the delete option. Another thing that you can do is you can tap on any individual device that's listed in there and tell it what things that you want to backup. So maybe you don't want to backup everything that is on your device, and you can manage that and maybe save a little bit of storage space. So that's another cool little tip around managing iCloud backups and iCloud backup storage. I received an email from a listener this week who purchased a 13-inch MacBook Pro back in March. And after using the device, they determined, you know, I probably need a little bit more RAM. They were doing a lot of video and photo editing, and it seemed like, you know, more RAM could help. And they emailed me asking about recommendations for upgrading RAM. And if you've listened to the show for a long time, you know I am a big fan of purchasing RAM from Crucial at crucial.com. I think they have great memory upgrades. One of the things I like about their memory upgrades is that they have this handy little wizard that you can use. You tell it what kind of computer you have, what model is, you know, what year, and they will recommend the appropriate RAM. Because I can never figure out, you know, what's the speed, what's the, you know, what kind of chips do I need? All that stuff is tricky. You can dig into it with something like Mac Tracker, but Crucial just makes it really easy to make sure that you get the right RAM. Well, if you try to do this for a more modern MacBook, you're going to find out that you're really out of luck. Because unfortunately, as I had to tell this particular listener, the only upgrade option for RAM on the current model MacBooks, MacBook Pros, or MacBook Airs even, is selling the old machine and getting a new one. It really stinks, but Apple has made the choice with all their recent models to actually solder the RAM to the motherboard. So they do not have slots. You cannot upgrade them. And that's true of all of the current models that Apple sells of the MacBook lines. And this is the MacBook Pro, and the Air. It doesn't matter which variant of MacBook you have. They all have the RAM set up this way. And going even further, the new MacBook also has its flash storage soldered to the board. So you're not going to be able to upgrade your disk space in that model either. So whatever you buy is what you have. And I actually fully expect with the new MacBook Air and the new MacBook Pro models that Apple is going to adopt this strategy moving forward. So storage and RAM being locked to whatever you buy on the device and not being able to get in there and upgrade. I actually think, you know, honestly, they are going to discontinue the MacBook Air moving forward and replace it with more MacBook models. So I think we're going to have MacBooks and MacBook Pros, but either way, soldered on RAM, soldered on flash storage. And this, I think, serves as a good reminder that when you buy a new MacBook, any one of the MacBook lines now, and more than ever, you need to think about this. You need to make sure that you get a model with the most RAM and the most storage you think you are ever going to need. And because you're not going to have the option to add more later, unfortunately. It stinks, but that's the way it is moving forward. Luckily, at least for now, this is not the case on the desktops. Most of the ones that Apple sells do not have this issue. The one exception is the 21.5-inch iMac. It is not RAM upgradable. The other models are, or at least not very easily. It might not even have slots. I don't remember specifically, but I know that one is, you know, not user upgradable on the RAM. Everything else you're okay with on the desktop lineups, but again, I don't know that that's going to be that way for very long. So it's just a new buying decision that we're going to have to think about as we're buying a new Mac. Make sure you're getting the most amount of RAM and the most amount of storage that you think you are ever going to need, and factor that into your budget when you're considering a new machine. Last thing that I have for you this week is my thing of the moment. We haven't done one of these in a while, just simply because I haven't found anything that I was really excited about. But I did get something this week that I am super excited about, and is actually way cooler than I thought it would be. Do you remember the ViewMaster? You know, the little thing you hold up to your eyes, made by Mattel. It's got the little film discs that you slide in the top, and then you click it, right? And you get little 3D images and scenes. And so I remember as a kid, I had Star Wars ones or Scooby-Doo ones, but they also had nature and wildlife. You know, it was like a stereoscopic viewer. I think they actually still sell classic ViewMasters and you can get them, but there now is a new updated version that just hit this week. It's called the ViewMaster Virtual Reality. And I picked up the starter pack kit at Target. It runs $29.99 US. And it comes with what they call a sample reel, which is really just this augmented reality target. It's a little plastic thing. It actually doesn't slide into the top, so that's a little bit of a disappointment. But you kind of put it down on the table, and you point the ViewMaster virtual reality thing at it, and then what it does is it recognizes the little code that's on the disc and unlocks content that's actually within three apps that you have to download from the App Store. And I guess I should back up because I didn't tell you, this ViewMaster doesn't take discs. What it takes is your iPhone. You actually slot your iPhone into it. It's got a little holder, and you dock the iPhone into it. You close it up. You install the app, and then you point the thing at the target, and then it unlocks the content in one of three different apps. And the three different apps that they have right now are a space app and a wildlife app and a destinations app. And this is a sample reel, so all of the content in each one of the apps is not fully unlocked with the sample reel. You actually have to unlock the additional content, and that content costs $14.99 per app. So a little bit on the pricey side, unfortunately. But still, it's some pretty cool content. You know, the space one has like star maps and it has 3D models. The demo reel shows you a 3D model of the space shuttle, and you can actually spin it around in 3D inside the viewer and take a look at it. The wildlife one lets you go to three different areas and see animals in the outback and the Amazon and the savannah. It has videos and information. And again, this is all virtual reality, so you can look around in 360 degrees at the environment. So you'll be standing in the outback and you look over to the left and there's some kangaroos grazing, and then you can get information and videos and things on the kangaroos. It's actually really, really cool. The coolest part of the sample reel, I thought, though, was the destinations application. It has four different locations that you can actually visit. It has a tour of Greece, the Statue of Liberty, the Tower of London, and a Mayan city. And you can actually virtually walk through the environments. You kind of click on a little directional icon and you move from space to space. But then once you're in an area, you can look around in 360. You can look at the buildings and the vistas and things like that. And you can pull up little, there's little information terminals that you can click on and pull up information about what you're looking at. And it's really, really cool. It's, again, a lot cooler than I thought it would be, especially when you're using your iPhone, which is this great high-resolution display to kind of look at this stuff. So you load your phone in, and it works with an iPhone or an Android device. For iPhone models, it supports the 5, the 5C, the 5S, the 6, the 6 Plus, and, of course, the 6S and 6S Plus because they're the same size. And it's a whole lot of fun and really amazing, but it gets even better because the viewer itself is actually 100% compatible with Google Cardboard. And if you know anything about Google Cardboard, they actually have a Google Cardboard app for iOS, and you can get virtual reality experiences through that. And I was looking around, there's also additional apps on the iOS store that are Google Cardboard apps. And so they have things like virtual tours of other locations. They have roller coaster simulators. They have games. There's a music concert that is Paul McCartney. I was blanking on the Beatles' name. Paul McCartney has like a whole virtual music concert, so you can, you know, feel like you're up on stage with Paul McCartney if you're into that sort of thing. And unlike Google Cardboard, the ViewMaster viewer is really well-crafted, sturdy plastic holder. It's basically, you know, a fancy iPhone holder with a little, it has just like the old ViewMaster, the little, you know, clicky slide advancer. Although in this case, really what it does is it activates a little capacitive touch sensor inside the device that taps on an area of your iPhone to add interactivity. You know, that's what enables you to kind of click on different things within the viewer. It comes with a little adapter for the smaller phones. And about my only complaint about it, it is really well made. I think $30 is not too bad because it's basically like a fancy iPhone case. So $30 iPhone case most people spend on. But it's an iPhone case that gives you a virtual reality experience. How cool is that? My only complaint about it is it has a latch that kind of closes. The latch doesn't always close securely, so you kind of got to push forward on it, make sure it's locked in. Otherwise, you could be looking around and the drawer sort of sort of drops down and your iPhone folds down. It won't fall out. The iPhone's held in very, very securely, but it just detracts from the experience. But other than that, really cool. And I'm just looking around for more virtual reality, you know, more Google Cardboard content. And it's looking like ViewMaster is going to put out additional content. I wish it was a little bit more affordable. You can also buy some of the reels, I guess, in-store in the physical packs and get more like 3D augmented reality models that you can interact with. That's versus just doing the in-app purchase thing, which only gives you the additional content. You don't get the augmented reality experience with that. So, and I think pricing in the store is about the same. It's probably around $15 for a little reel pack or whatever they're calling it. But cool thing to check out. It's available at like Walmart and Target and Amazon, $29.99 US, and it's called the ViewMaster Virtual Reality. So check it out. That's my thing of the moment for this week. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices, along with PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can check out all their great software and get more information and details over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And TunnelBear, really simple VPN app that allows you to browse privately and get around blocked websites. You can try it today for free. Just head to tunnelbear.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have any feedback for me, want to make a comment or have a question, you can send me audio comments or email to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9, and leave a voicemail. If you're on Skype, you can leave voicemail on Skype as well. My Skype username is TheMacCast. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you're online, you use social media, you will find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can also check out the MacCast Facebook page at facebook.com/TheMacCast. Or if Google Plus is your social media platform of choice, we do have a Google Plus community, and you can find that at google.com/plusMacCast, and that's the plus symbol, plus MacCast. With that, that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.